this week's lecture built on from last week's lecture, which was about English society in the 16th century and Native America before Europeans ever arrived, and introduces you to the idea of an imperial England. England interested in acquiring an empire for the first time. And I'm going to trace you through how England conceives of itself as an imperial nation, how it starts on colonising efforts in Ireland, and then for the very first time overseas in North Carolina in the 1580s, and that's about where we'll get to today. When we talk about the British Empire, we often think about the zenith of the British Empire in the 19th and very early 20th centuries. Perhaps 1914 is the zenith of the British Empire, with a quarter of the globe and a fifth of the world's population under British dominion. However, looking at it like that, it's very easy to forget what you can probably describe as the first British Empire, which started in the late 16th and early 17th century, and which helped to forge the British imperial mentality for the very first time. So some of the things to think about are, why is an overseas empire a good idea? Why do English authorities think that overseas expansionism is worthwhile? Once it made that decision, that it intended to be a colonising power, how did it actually manage to do it? It's one thing making a decision, it's another thing actually implementing that decision. Why are the English attracted to America? Why is America a target for colonisation fairly early on? I mean, pretty much immediately after Ireland. And how are the British, or the English, allowed to colonise? Why don't the other powers, especially Spain and France, why don't they stop them? Do they try to stop them? How effective are those attempts? So these are some of the sort of questions that we'll be thinking about today. The 15th century is a period of complete overthrow of all established ideas in Europe. And it's channeled by two different things. Firstly, the Renaissance, and secondly, the Reformation. The Reformation, which I mentioned briefly last week with regard to England, breaks the ideological monopoly of the church. It prevents the church from controlling how people think. It starts to think, make people think about the world as not quite as set in stone as the church would have you believe. Remember, they've been burning people for saying things like the earth revolves around the sun. Galileo is forced to recant as a heretic or some of his ideas. Well, the Reformation allows those sorts of ideas to gain ground a bit. And when we enter the Renaissance, which is all about science, really, it's about scientific inquiry, it's about rigorous empirical testing of ideas, and it's not just about art. I mean, you might think of the Renaissance as about art, but it's also about science. These two things allow for a new conceptualisation of the world, one that is far more advanced than had been in the Middle Ages. People are thinking beyond their boundaries, they're thinking outside the box, however you might want to put it. They're thinking, they're broadening their horizons. And these two things coincide with an era of what you can describe as the nation state. All these big monarchies in France and Spain and England are growing in power in this period. So we're going from a period in the Middle Ages when the papacy and the small states had bickered amongst themselves, and the papacy and the Holy Roman Empire had been the overarching, loosely governing institutions. And the monarchies had actually been relatively incapable of controlling large amounts of territory, to one where the French are consolidating French territory under the monarchy, and there's all those autonomous dukedoms are coming under the French control. In Spain, there's gradual unification of Spain and the expulsion of the Arabs. And in England, you've also, again, you've got consolidation of power under the Tudors. So So this is the era of that growing centralized state, which is important, I think, for future expansionisms. And it also becomes not only the era of the nation state, it very quickly becomes the age of empire. And it's firstly driven by commerce. European traders and merchants know the premium that is placed on exotic Eastern goods, such as silks, such as spices, which come from China and India and those sorts of faraway places. The problem they've got is that the 15th century, 1453, is the conquest of Constantinople by the Turks. And so the normal overland route between Europe and Asia, which is through the Middle East, is cut off. Or at least it's become a lot more dangerous because it's controlled by the Turks. And so when you've got people saying, well, actually, the Earth isn't flat, it's round, which are ideas that come out of the Renaissance and the Reformation, and you're allowed to say it because the church isn't going to burn you for heresy, then things like navigation, shipping, become a lot more significant, become a lot more important. And the Portuguese, in the 15th century, under their Prince Henry the Navigator, gradually island hop their way down the African coast, the Canaries, Madeira, the Azores, the Cape Verde Islands. These are all discovered by the Portuguese. And they round the Cape of Good Hope, South Africa, in the 1480s. They get to India by the 1490s. So they're pioneering new sea routes to Asia. In 1492, Columbus approaches the Spanish monarchy, Ferdinand de Isabella, and says, I can sail west to reach China. If the world is round, you just have to keep on sailing west and you'll get to China. This might be the quick way to China. Nobody really knows how far China is. Nobody knows how big the world is, really. And it's certainly a lot bigger than they think. Even their wildest estimates are far short of how far away China really is sailing west. Columbus himself is a slightly obscure figure. For many years, it was thought that he was perhaps Genoese or Venetian. Few people thought he was actually Spanish. Current research suggests that he's actually probably Catalan near Barcelona. And one of the reasons why he deliberately hides his ethnic origins is because the Catalans had not been friendly to Ferdinand Isabella, the king and queen of Spain. And it's probably political, trying to keep himself as a bit more of an obscure figure. But anyway. Columbus gets this commission from Ferdinand Isabella. He sails west, he discovers the Caribbean islands, he probably first lands on Hispaniola, which is modern day Santo Domingo, and over the next 10 years or so he goes back across the Atlantic four times, and lots of other people also follow in his footsteps, and so he's credited with the discovery of America, though there's lots of issues about the word discovery with America. Because he's the first person who starts up a regular traversing of the Atlantic. And so he deserves a lot of credit for that, bringing America much more readily into the consciousness of Europeans. The Spanish, of course, think, great, we've got these new islands, we've got these new territories, and they exploit that very, very rapidly by starting to conquer these lands and making them into Spanish territories. They're not just trading posts, they're not just visiting, they are controlling these areas. And so it's not too long before Cortes leads the conquest of Mexico in 1519, the great Aztec Empire in Central America. And Pizarro conquers Peru, the great Inca Empire, in the 1530s. And this coincides with the emergence of a superpower in Europe, and that superpower is embodied by Charles V. And Charles V is the happy inheritor of numerous territories around Europe and around the world. As this map shows you, Castile and Aragon, the two Spanish monarchies, are unified in the marriage of Ferdinand and Isabella. Charles V is their son, so he inherits a unified kingdom of Spain from them. 1492, we've seen the expulsion of the Moors from Granada, so he controlled the peninsula apart from Portugal. Though even for a time in the 16th century, the Spanish controlled Portugal as well. Aragon had also controlled southern Italy and Sardinia. And through another one of his relations, he inherits territories in the Netherlands, in Central Europe, and what becomes known as the Austrian Empire, with Austria itself and Hungary, Moravia, Bohemia, and Silesia, all these Central European territories. And so Charles V controls all this. And it's not long, actually, before he's elected Holy Roman Emperor, which gives him at least nominal jurisdiction over the entirety of Germany. He's an incredibly important figure. And you add to that his Spanish-American territories, starting off with New Spain, but being added to by what's described here as New Andalusia and New Castile, but it's the sorts of Central American and South American territories which are going to bring in vast amounts of revenue to the Spanish treasury, because in both Central America and South America there are vast amounts of precious metals, silver and gold, and it's these precious metals which are shipped to Europe which finance Charles V and his sons Philip II's European war campaigns. That's why he becomes such an influential figure, because he controls this money. He can channel this money and these resources into his wars in Europe. So the Spanish, through a variety of reasons, really, click in the 17th century and the 16th century. They become the most important nation on the planet, really, in terms of territory they control and their political importance. If you remember back to last week, England's in a bit of a mess. Politically, economically, you've got the issue of the end of the Wars of the Roses, you've got the slow consolidation of power into the Tudors, you've got economic problems in England, you've got the decline of the cloth industry, all those sorts of things which I talked about last week are making England not even on Spain's, not even in the same room, let alone the same league as Spain. The only toe they had poked into overseas voyages had been in 1497, when Henry VII had sponsored a Venetian, a man called, anglicised to John Cabot. His Venetian Italian name is Giovanni Cabotti. He had travelled across the Atlantic looking for the famed Northwest Passage, the one that would cross those lands at the northern latitudes and get to China and Japan the quick way. And he very quickly discovers that you can't do that because you very quickly run into the ice cap. And so there is no Northwest Passage for him to discover. So he discovers bits of Newfoundland and Labrador and, bits of Canada, but doesn't actually get anywhere. And when Henry VIII realises that the only thing he's bringing back are a few, seal furs and the odd bit of walrus tusk, that he's not actually that interested in spending money financing these type of voyages if he's not going to get the reward that the Spanish are getting. So he's not interested, and colonisation above all needs this sort of political impetus. And also England is very militarily much, much weaker than Spain in the 16th century, for most of the 16th century. But what they do, what the Tudors do, is pioneer on pioneering the reconquest of Ireland, which is something that will lay the foundations for stepping across the Atlantic again later. Ireland, which has got a slightly complicated history, had never been part of the Roman Empire, unlike most of Britain, but not Scotland. It had a number of different kings, and had been invaded and sort of conquered by the Normans following their conquest of England in 1066. So we're talking 11th, 12th century. Ireland is assimilated like that. But what happens is that the Normans over the next 300 or 400 years become sort of assimilated into the Irish population rather than the other way around. And it doesn't look very English, that society, in 1500. It actually looks a lot more Irish than it ever had before. The Tudors, though, seek to regain English influence in Ireland. They seek to re-establish English influence. And so both Henry VIII and then and Queen Elizabeth launch new campaigns in Ireland to conquer parts of Ireland, to bring it under English control. And it's led by a number of soldiers and merchant adventurers, sort of venture capitalists in a way, who are looking to make a quick buck. And these sorts of people often are later involved in American colonisation. The success of the military conquests, which is somewhat inevitable because the Irish are not organised militarily like the English are organised, leaves new areas of land which are open for colonisation, for migrants from England to go and settle in Ireland. And especially those who are seeking land holdings to support a lifestyle which they can't get in England. Land is expensive in England. If you are the second son or third or fourth or younger son of somebody who does own land, you don't tend to inherit it yet. All land is concentrated in the eldest son. So it's an opportunity for these disenfranchised or ignored group of people to get their own estates and their own lands in this manner. The native Irish population, the Gaelic Irish, who were, of course, mainly Catholic, are very badly mistreated by these English colonisers. They're treated as serfs, you know, almost as slaves in all but name. And there are frequent accounts of massacres, you know, quasi-genocide committed against the Irish. And that's because the English generally don't see the Irish as even, you know, that human. They're seen as like a subspecies, people who haven't quite evolved to be humans. They haven't quite made it. And this again mirrors some of the treatment that's meted out to Native Americans in North America. And it's easy to ignore Ireland because it becomes part of the UK for a period of time. But in the 17th century, you get about 200,000 migrants from England to Ireland, to colonise Ireland. And that's probably twice as many people who went from England to America. So we shouldn't underestimate the influence and the power and the example set by Ireland for colonisers who went to America. And if you're interested in that, you should read some of the work by Nicholas Canning, who's written articles and books on this sort of topic of Ireland and its precedent that it sets. And this shows you how the English expand away from the area around Dublin known as the Pale. And you may have heard of the expression, so-and-so is beyond the Pale. Well, this is where it comes from. The Pale was the English-controlled area of Ireland. And if you lived beyond the Pale, you were out in the Badlands, you were out in the wild west sort of territory. Well, gradually, there are areas which are conquered. And it's these areas, like in Leinster, where you get more and more English settlers, which displace the native Irish peoples. You also see up in Northern Ireland, the area that is settled by Scottish Protestants, and eventually they become the Protestant population of Northern Ireland, which is, you know, where the influence comes from, I guess. Western Ireland, though, remains fairly remote and undeveloped. Areas of Connaught and Munster aren't really that affected by colonisation that much. There are several ways in which you can see Ireland as this blueprint for colonisation. Firstly, the joint stock companies, which become very important for pooling resources in order to fund colonisation efforts in America, are first tried out here in Ireland. And there are tried out elsewhere in the world. There's the Muscovy Company, there's the Levant Company, the Hudson's Bay Company in Canada, the Royal African Company. These are groups of merchant adventurers who have the resources they pull together to fund these sorts of trips. there's a genre of promotional literature which is created to whip up popular interest in Ireland and later in North America, to disseminate knowledge about these new places, to encourage migration from England to these new places. And that tactic is something that is used again and again in North America. I mentioned about the attitude towards the Irish. And then you get the idea of the individuals, people who have been to Ireland, have been involved in the conquest of parts of Ireland, are exactly the same individuals who lead the first colonisation efforts in America. So even the government thinks that these are the right people to start colonisation efforts in North America. People like Richard Grenville, Humphrey Gilbert, and of course the famous Walter Raleigh. But why is England even interested, even bothered, about an empire? Partly, it's sort of a mixture of fear and envy of Spain. They can see the amount of money that Spain is getting from colonisation efforts overseas. Huge amounts of gold, silver, precious jewels are funding Spanish wars. I mean, to be honest, the British were probably overly concerned about Spain because the Spanish don't look after this money. They do spend it pretty rapidly. And it doesn't lay a strong foundation for the Spanish domination of the world for the 5 centuries. Spanish decline is already started by 1600. And it becomes sort of English policy to try and undermine the Spanish. And that's partly because of the fear that the Spanish might turn their attentions to the English after the English break with Rome in 1534. And so what the English government does is that it grants what's so-called privateering licences to ship captains, allowing them to raid Spanish ships, capture Spanish ships, steal their treasure and their goods. A significant proportion of gold from Peru and Mexico ends up in London because we steal it. However, the Spanish gradually get wise to that. They launch things like the convoy system, which is what's used actually in World War II, where you have several different ships protected by naval warships, and it becomes increasingly difficult for a small raiding ship to attack these big galleons. And you are conducting these, what is basically licensed piracy, at a distance of several thousand miles from your home base. If your ship's damaged or your crew are hurt, it's very difficult to replace and repair your ships. So what you end up with is a logical train of thought that suggests that a base in America would be practical, useful, that would be a good thing to have. So I think the first idea of an American base is a sort of strategic stroke military reason. Secondly, you get the idea that American colonies might have some kind of economic impact for Europe. They may enable you to grow products or goods or crops and produce things that currently you have to import. So there might be a good economic benefit to having American colonies. And they're always talking about citrus fruits, like oranges, which, you know, sticks in their craw, they have to buy them from Spain. Silks. They're always trying to, you know, grow silkworms in America. And vines. I think the English have a strong taste for wine, but they don't have to buy it from the French. And these ideas are made much more prominent and popular by the work of propagandists, people like Richard Hakluyt. In fact, there are two Richard Hakluyts, who are an uncle and a nephew. And sometimes it's easy to get confused between the two because they both write this kind of propaganda. But they write documents such as the Discourse on Western Planting, which makes a very strong case for saying this is why England should be involved in imperial advances. And those documents are being circulated around court, around the people who work for Elizabeth I, who are the people who are going to make the decisions about whether to allow these sorts of things to go ahead. And eventually, they do get a grant, a patent granted. It's granted to Humphrey Gilbert, who is half-brother to Walter Raleigh, and it's a very vague patent. It basically says you can settle anywhere that you can find land between Florida and Canada, which is a pretty liberal kind of patent. It's not like you have to go to this latitude, find land here, and live there. It says basically if you hit land anywhere between these latitudes, you can settle there. And there are Gilbert and Raleigh in their typical Elizabethan dress, and they both look like fairly hard men. I mean, Raleigh's even dressed in his armour, showing his military might, his military prowess. And they both look like fairly fierce Elizabethan gentlemen who would have no truck with, you know, executing a few Irish rebels or stringing up a few Indians to make a point. They're both sort of hard men. So, we get to Roanoke, the Roanoke Voyages, which are the first attempt by the English to settle in America. The first voyage lands on a small island called Roanoke Island, which is just inside the Outer Banks of North Carolina, in July 1584. This is really a scouting expedition. Nearly all the people who go there are soldiers. A lot of them have been in Ireland. They've got experience of new settlements, about hostile landings. They pick Roanoke Island because it is defensible. It is not visible from the Atlantic, therefore hopefully the Spanish can't see it. Because they are worried that Spanish shipping might see a settlement and come and attack it. So the fact that it's not easy to see from the sea is important. It's also protected by the Outer Banks, so it's protected from the worst of the weather, hurricanes and such like, storms. The Outer Banks, you have to navigate between the Outer Bank Islands to get to Roanoke, and again that's a little bit tricky. And it's the defensive capabilities of Roanoke which are the most attractive. It's also unpopulated, or at least it's not permanently inhabited. Local Indian groups from the mainland, from nearby islands, have been on Roanoke, but they don't live there permanently, and that again is important. And they find the land is, you know, okay, it's fertile, they could grow crops there, the Indians certainly grow crops there, therefore this will do as a base as good as any. You know, it's got the defensive elements to it, and it's got the possibility of being self-sustaining. They capture two local Indians to take back with them. One of them called Manteo, the other one Chase. And this is quite a common thing that Europeans do when they first go somewhere new in the Americas. They capture local people, kidnap them basically, and take them back to their country and make them learn English, which is much easier than actually you learning a different language if you force somebody else to learn your language. And these two Indians will return and act as translators for the English. A year later, a much larger expedition arrives. It's led by a soldier adventurer called Ralph Lane, who not only sort of spends his time on Roanoke Island, he actually mounts expeditions, exploratory expeditions, into the interior. He's the first Englishman to discover Chesapeake Bay. They're not first European. There had actually been a short-lived Jesuit settlement in Chesapeake Bay in the 1570s. But he thinks that the Chesapeake Bay is a much better place for a permanent settlement than Roanoke Island. It's got a deep water navigation, so you can bring ocean-going ships right inside the bay, which is protected and defensible. And there's a long-term plan that they're going to move away from Roanoke into Chesapeake Bay. He also takes with him on this voyage John White, who is an artist, and Thomas Harriot, who is a naturalist. And these two together create a pictorial record of life, of Native American life, or natural life, in North Carolina, pretty much at the point of European contact. An absolutely invaluable set of drawings and descriptions of these people and their lifestyles. There was a very good exhibition in the British Library this last summer of these drawings of John White. Absolutely fascinating. And there are some links on the North American Themes website, I think. And I think there might be links off the Early America page as well. However, the rest of the colonists aren't as enlightened as White and Harriet, and they are mainly young men, mainly with some experience of Ireland. They're looking for easy wealth. They're looking for gold. They're looking for, you know, goods they can trade in Europe. They're looking for, you know, a quick buck. And they don't really find it in North Carolina. And so what happens reasonably quickly is that they fall out with the local Indian tribes. And they mainly fall out over food. The English, the people, these merchant adventurers, soldiers, they're not agriculturalists. They're not into planting crops and nurturing crops and growing crops and eating crops. They're interested in stealing crops from Indians. And Indians very quickly get hacked off with that. And they go where English people can't find them. They just disappear into the interior. And the English start to go hungry with their food supply cut off. So when Francis Drake, here, arrives at Roanoke, having spent a busy few months plundering Spanish ships, and thinking his crew will have a bit of R&R at Roanoke, he'll rest up there, resupply his ship, and go out and do a bit more raiding. He actually gets to Roanoke and finds that he's the one supplying the colonists with food, that they don't have any food, and they're actually in desperate circumstances. And eventually, he takes all the remaining colonists in Roanoke back to England. And thus ends the second voyage. This here is Roanoke Island. These are the Carolina Outerbanks here. And as you can see, you have to navigate between the islands to get to Roanoke itself. This is John White's contemporary map, which, as you can see, is pretty accurate as maps go. Again, he's showing you where Roanoke Island is. It's here. And at the top there, you can see the opening to Chesapeake Bay. But you can see from this map just how far the English had explored a lot of the river systems nearby. Because his map is pretty accurate. And again, it's the images of, you know, all the shipping, which I think overestimates the amount of shipping that came anywhere near America, which is interesting. But also, he's already written coats of arms into parts of America, showing how the English were interested in claiming that land for themselves. On Roanoke Island, the first thing the English did was build a fort. There was a fort rally. Most likely on this kind of design. Pretty small, with a big palisade around it, a ditch around it. It's all about defence, gun emplacements, so you can fight off hostile Indians. And there are, the earthworks are still visible if you go to Roanoke Island. I've been there. You don't really get a sense of how impressive it was because it's surrounded by trees now, so it looks just like a few hills. Well, they're only about 4 or 5 feet high, so it doesn't look that impressive at all. There's not much else there, to be honest. And these are some of the drawings. I'm going to show you some of the drawings that John White did. This is the village of Pomayuk. Interestingly, again, the Indian village, also surrounded by a palisade, for defensive reasons. It shows you, you can learn things about like the design of dwellings along the 16th century Algonquins. Both their larger public communal buildings, which are these big domed places, and the smaller, you know, personal living spaces. The fact that there would be a communal fire, which one of people would sit and talk about things. These drawings of individual Native Americans are again very interesting. This is known as the Flyer, some kind of shaman religious figure. It's because he's got a bird attached to his head. What I think is quite interesting about a lot of these paintings of individual Native Americans is that they're very muscular, strong, healthy people. There's no sort of ethnographic sense that he's thinking of the Indians as a weak people, or the Europeans are healthier and stronger. I mean, and this guy, you know, could pass as a, you know, Renaissance Greek god, couldn't he? You know, he's that sort of muscly, you know, and well built, tall, strong figures. This is again another one of White's drawings, a North American butterfly. one of his most famous. He's very good at watercolours. Okay. The colonists arrive back in with these soldiers, adventurers, whatever you. Arrived back in England in late 1586, and they all know about what's going to happen next. But in the end, they decide they are going to go back to Roanoke. There is going to be a third voyage, but it's going to be quite different. The voyage this time is not going to be soldiers, adventurers, people looking out to make quick money. It's going to be farmers, people who know how to subsist in that environment. It's going to be people looking to stay there for the long haul, not just for the easy money they can make. And it's not just going to be young men. It's going to be families. It's going to be men and their wives and their children. It's going to be like an English community transplanted across to America to create a new type of community, a new village life. It's meant to be a long-lasting, permanent settlement that can reproduce itself because there's a mixture of genders and can sustain itself because the population have the skills necessary to survive in that kind of environment. The farming, the hunting, the carpentry skills, those sorts of things which are necessary to make successful communities. John White, the artist, is promoted to be governor. He's thought to be a very good person to choose as governor because he's got experience of going to America. He knows what the environment's like. He knows what the Indians are like. He's been out drawing pictures of them. So who else could be better to be governor? And so this third voyage arrives in Roanoke. They all disembark, they set about their unpacking their ships, and they realise pretty quickly that they haven't got enough supplies. They need more essential items to really make this colony important, make this colony really thrive. And the colonists decide that it should be White himself who goes back to England. Now, it was common practice in all of these voyages, I mean, why Drake had rescued the colonists the previous year, that the ships who go to America, they don't stay there. What they do is they go and drop people off, and then they go back. And actually, when they drop people off, usually they then go and see if they can find any Spanish galleons to steal stuff from, and then they go. So, if White doesn't return with the voyage then, he's not going to go back for a long time, not until the next voyage comes out, which could be a year. So the colonists persuade White, as the governor, as the person who's got the best connections in London, he's the person who has to go back to get these more supplies, to arrange another voyage for the next year, you know, and come back. And so White reluctantly agrees, and he leaves his own daughter and his son-in-law, and his newly born granddaughter, a girl called Virginia Dare, who is, as far as we know, the first white child born in North America. He leaves his family at Roanoke. However, of course, he gets back to England late 1787, when England is in absolute turmoil because of the threat of the Spanish Armada. Everybody knows the Armada is coming. Nobody knows when it's coming, where it's going to strike. And so they spend a huge amount of 1588, thinking about how they're going to defend the kingdom. And of course it's going to involve keeping every single possible ship that he's seaworthy for defence, and even some that aren't seaworthy. So there's no way that White can actually get a ship, fill it with supplies and colonists, and go back to America. And even after the Spanish Armada is defeated, partly by brave seamanship and partly by the weather, the ships become immediately available, because people don't know in England whether the Armada is going to reform, because they don't really know what's happened to it. It just sort of went up the North Sea and then disappeared. I mean, they don't know that most of it was battered into smithereens on the islands of Scotland and Ireland, and very few ships actually made it back to Spain. They're worried throughout 1589 that the Armada is going to come again. So it's not until 1590 that he finally managed to persuade somebody to give him a ship so he can go back to Roanoke. But when he gets there, there's no sign of the colonists. All there is a warning sign carved into one of the trees with the letter CRO, which he takes to mean the colonists have moved to a neighbouring island, an island called Croatoan Island. Perhaps they've been forced to do that, perhaps that was just seen as a better decision for them. Better place to live, maybe have better access to water or whatever. But White's not able to find them. And there's several other voyages in the 1590s to try and find the colony of Roanoke, what happened to them, to discover what happened to them. And we don't know what happened to them. They never were found. Most likely, they were left in an environment where the Indians were already hostile towards them, and the colony was attacked, and the men at least would have been killed by the Indians. Women and children may have been absorbed into these Indian tribes. I mean, sometimes the women and children would be killed as well, but equally, sometimes Indians did absorb these sorts of people into their own tribes to boost their own numbers. And there are sporadic reports 20 or 30 years later of blonde-haired Indian children who may have come from Roanoke settlers. But there's no way of knowing what happened to these people and where they went. So, Roanoke tells us a number of different things. It tells us that the people behind the Roanoke voyages, the organisers, the colonisers, the people in power in England, had thought very carefully about colonisation efforts and why colonisation was going to take place. Roanoke is originally a privateering base. Then it turns into an exploration site. Finally, it becomes a permanent settlement. And the failure of Roanoke, which is a disaster really, should have made it very plain to anybody in England who was listening that you needed a large and sustained and significant amount of support, material and otherwise, from the mother country for several years after fighting the colony. You can't just throw a bunch of people into North America and expect them to just get on with it. You have to support them and sustain them for a number of years. You needed to have proper goals, a proper purpose to colonisation. Otherwise, colonisation is very much haphazard, unfocused, and ineffective. And thirdly, you really did need to secure good relationships with Indians. Because if you didn't have that, then you were hampering yourself. Because the Indians knew how to survive in that environment. The Indians knew how to farm, they knew how to fish, they knew how to move around to the best locations for settlements. And if you pretend that you don't need to learn anything from Indians, you're hampering yourself from the very start. So, England's imperial ambitions have sort of had a bit of a false start. They're like a damp squib. They've sort of gone off all guns blazing and they've all fizzled out fairly embarrassingly. And in 1600, when the Spanish had been in the Americas for about a century, there was no permanent English settlement in North America. But you can argue that Ireland and later Roanoke had given them the taste for colonisation, shown that they could do it if they had the right resources in the right places at the right time. And they still dreamed of colonisation being profitable. So, think of it more as a pause than as a full stop.